Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
You are a human animal. You are a very special breed. For you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read.
From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Michael Silverblatt, and this is Bookworm. Today, I am very pleased to have as my guest A.S. Byatt, Antonia Byatt, whose new novel, The Children's Book, has just been published by Knopf. I'm thrilled by it because it's one of those books that allows you to spend time with families not your own and to go visiting with them. It takes place from 1895 to 1914 approximately, and is about the period just before World War I, when things are both becoming very complex and at the same time breaking down. You get some of the perfect works of art, the importance of being earnest, for instance, during this period. And at the same time, an intricacy is giving rise to something beyond intricacy, something too complicated to hold together, which is, in a sense, what this book is about and the sense that what holds a family together is perhaps disappearing during this period.
I think so. I think it was a time which on the surface appeared to be very golden and sunny. A lot of British writing is about sort of being out in the fields, out in the woods, children running, a kind of extraordinary happiness. And there was a lot of hopefulness because of the socialists and the Fabian Society and people really trying to deal with things like poverty. And at the same time, as happened, I think, to us in the 60s, as you loosen the rigorous moral structures of the Victorian period and you get people believing in free love, you get muddle occurring, particularly in a world before the very useful contraceptive. I mean, before a contraceptive which really worked. and you get these very, very big families. And again, it's both a beginning and an end because the big families believed in talking to children as though they were people, the big middle-class families. So you get this sense that children really are people whose views are consulted, whose ideas are important. And at the same time, they're somehow exploited, or I increasingly found that they were, not only by the dreadful English public school system, boarding school system, but by those parents who loved them so much. So it's a kind of double bind, I think. And the same, to a certain extent, was true of the whole of Europe as well. Things got looser and laxer, and people got less certain of where they were going or where they should be going.
It's a very interesting book because I think, let's face it, it's the kind of book that fewer people are going to be able to write in the future. The big family novel may be gradually a thing of the past as people lose more and more track of their families, of their children, of their parents. So this is a sort of novel that comes after Jane Austen, but before the novels of people in groups. I noticed that during the 60s, what we had were novels like Catch-22 or like Pynchon's V, novels where people are not related, who function in groups of a totally different kind. This is the last gasp, in a sense, this period, of a novel that can still, with some confidence, tell the story of generations.
This is very interesting because, of course, I agree entirely. And in all the societies I know, in the States, in Europe, in Britain, people are mobile. People have come from far away in the world, and your next door neighbor may have come from Sri Lanka or Australia or simply Poland, because the Eastern Europe, and they are intermarrying. And in Britain, people are becoming racially very complicated. However, people in Britain, and I think probably here, are obsessively consulting websites about genetics. They are trying to trace relations as though they felt they needed relations. Indeed, my own husband has suddenly discovered a half-brother. And my husband's 70-something and his half-brother is 80-something, and they have been reunited for the first time. It's very, very strange. Both the need for families and, as you say, groups. I thought, as you spoke of Mary McCarthy's The Group, which straddles exactly the two periods you're talking about.
Yes, indeed. Yes, indeed. And this, the central family is the Wellwood family, and the book would appear to revolve around the lives of Olive and Humphrey Wellwood. But what's so interesting about this book is that everything you expect is not what you're given. The family extends wider and wider. First, we watch an orphan taken in by the Wellwoods, eventually sent over to the floods. The floods are headed by a patriarchal ceramicist, very gifted, a genius who's doing work that no one has ever done with glazes. And fascinatingly, Auger's Dart obsess this novel. Bits of very spectacularly arranged jewelry, pots, and puppets. Why?
I find this hard to answer, but as I write more, I become more and more interested in crafted things. Balzac said that the world and the novel consisted of men and women and things were the things that the men and women made. And I increasingly think that sort of saving things and understanding things, embroidery, jewelry, pottery, isn't just a luxury, but somehow an essential part of being human. I used to think of that entirely in terms of writing, and then I got to thinking of it in terms of painting as some other human way of making things. But now I've got very interested in people making objects, and I like it, I think, because human beings don't need to do it, and yet they do it. And somehow it's both innocent and complicated and harmlessly human, making things. Unless, of course, you're causing all sorts of ecological disasters with the acids you use to make your metals or something like that. But as sort of homo faber, I'm interested in men who make things.
And it seems as if, while the family, though not necessarily falling apart, they seem, in fact, to exist in a kind of stasis in this book. The women enter sort of comatose phases in the Flood family and in the Wellwood family, and the children are left to, in a sense, find their own bonds among the familial groups around them as they detect and discover that they may share a mother but not a father, or in some cases vice versa. And what's coming together is the Victoria and Albert Museum, or a massive puppet enterprise called Tom Underground, that the works of art and the collections of art seem to be coalescing while families are, in certain ways, dispersing.
Now, this is this is a description of the novel I have never thought of, and strikes me immediately as being both extremely interesting and probably right. It is the coalescing of the Victoria and Albert that surprised me most about the book. And also there's a long passage about the Great Universal Exhibition in Paris in 1900, which is the Victoria and Albert writ large, sort of human beings showing all the creations of civilization, including the first real uses of electricity, which has just come. And it's something, of course, to do with the means of living. These families began sort of having a country house or possibly a townhouse. They would have had servants because they're not mostly the working class. They would still have travelled until towards the end of the novel by horse-drawn transport. So their social circle was restricted to where they could get easily to in a carriage. There was no kind of entertainment like television, so they were thrown either on their own conversation or on making things which they shared, like perhaps a puppet theatre, you know, such as in fact Goethe had, out of which all his work came. And in a way, I half envy them, and I'm half glad I live in the modern world with all the kinds of devices we have to move rapidly and to change place. I think particularly the women. You said the women become comatose. One of the main themes of the novel is the emancipation of women, but it's written from the side, not from the center. Some of the characters become suffragists. Some of them are just, and this is one of the major themes of everything I've written in a way, some of them are just women trapped in houses with good minds who feel they ought not to be trapped in a house, and that they ought not to feel that the house is a trap. And Olive writes her way out of the trap by writing fairy stories about underground fairy lands and people descending into deep mines in search of their stolen shadow. And she feels a kind of triumphalism because she, in fact, is the breadwinner in that house. He leaves his job in the bank and becomes a sort of virtuous journalist writing good, it isn't even really left-wing, good reforming journalism of one kind and another, but he no longer makes a living. And she increasingly does make a living. And that gives her a kind of triumphal sense, I think, of power, which early working women must have got.
Yes, Olive and Humphrey have 7 children, but there seems to be what I would say would be a new model, and it's described in a passage about how European royalty, while representative of their countries, are also familially related, so that Kaiser Wilhelm is the cousin of the King of England and dutifully attends all of the various coronations, weddings, celebrations that will occur, but in fact, when it comes to it, will go to war against his relatives. So too, it seems, the way these families break.
It was a time when paths were broken. And going back to what you said about the First World War, I had one of those, you know, writers have very lucky moments. And thinking about the family of the crowned heads of Europe, which included the Danish royal family, the Russian royal family, the British royal family, the German royal family, I found that there was a cabaret in Munich called the Elf Scharfrichter, the 11 executioners. And they put on a puppet play, which suited the structure of my novel very well, called Eine feine Familie, A Beautiful Family, which was about the squabblings of the crowned heads of Europe and caricatured them. And I came to the conclusion after doing a lot of work that actually the First World War was a huge family quarrel.
I'm Michael Silverblatt, and you're listening to Bookworm from the studios of KCRW. I'm talking with A.S. Byatt, author most recently of the children's book, published by Knopf. We'll continue shortly. I'm Michael Silverblatt, this is Bookworm, and I'm talking with A.S. Byatt about her new novel, The Children's Book. Now, the patterns that exist in the book, literary, historical, familial, are webs within webs, and in a way at the center of all these webs is that question of the puppet show. There are German puppet masters who are revealed to be related to some of the families in our book. And in fact, what we're watching are people who both are and aren't dangling from the strings of the puppet masters. The puppet masters might be said to be the economy or various ideas about class, but these are people who are in the process, or rather part of their puppet show is the demonstration within the show of cutting the strings. And eventually in the huge production, Tom Underground, shadows, strings, retrieving connections of various sorts, but in particular, a play that will be put together with human beings interacting with puppets.
I think in one of the original ideas I had for this novel was to do with German fairy stories, which, I mean, all fairy stories have a puppet-like quality. The original folktale fairy story has very rigid patterns. People can only move in certain ways. There's a wonderful writer called Lüthi in Switzerland who points out that only certain colors, red, black, white, gold, and silver, appear in most fairy stories, not even green. If you have three things, you will always have three things, you know. You will have a gold one, a silver one, and one with the color of the stars, speaking of the dresses that are given to the Cinderella princess. You know that the hero and heroine will get married and will live happily ever after, and you know that the bad person will be punished. And I started out with this idea, particularly of the very ferocious German fairy tale, which is at once comforting and terrifying. And in a sense, the puppet master within the family is Olive, who has written a fairy story, a different story for each of her children in a different book, beautifully decorated with different sort of leaves and patterns and colors.
Not for publication, but for each child.
Not for publication, but for each child. So this is a wonderful present of a private story. At the same time, of course, using our military metaphor that's been lurking around, it is an invasion of the child's mind. She is giving the child a story rather than allowing the child to make its own story.
Now, I have a funny final question, because I think it has to do with how destiny is worked out, if indeed it is destiny, in this book. You mentioned the Tingle Tangle drama. What is it?
Now, Tingle Tangle...
It's a German puppet theater that Wedekind participated in. As I understand it, you know, when I came upon it in the book, I'd known a little bit about it, but it's the kind of mixture of melodrama and comedy...
That's right.
And terror, where you hardly can guess what can happen next, because anything can happen next.
This is a very German thing, and as the Germans got more and more into the book, I felt that in a way, the English sort of fairies flitting in the bushes were drawn into the Tingle Tangle, and I suppose I don't know if tangle in German means tangle. I mean, tingle-inga-linga is the same thing in both English and German. It's a kind of, mocking, rhyming structure. But I think it's probably to do with bell ringing as well. And I just like the phrase.
What I felt while reading was that World War I was the culmination of a tingle-tangle drama. That something that you couldn't see was nevertheless, I say waiting for you, you say accidentally there, but it's both.
Well, fate is chance, and chance is fate, and the two are the same thing in the end. And in a sense, fate is waiting for all of us in one form or another, and we shall experience it as chance, unless somebody's written us into a drama which has a clear sort of sense of destiny going along from beginning to end. It's a very interesting question as to the freedom in characters have within a story, which is A, being directed by an author in order to make a beautiful form, and B, being in this case very strongly directed by history so that only certain things can happen. But those are my characters who survive, and those who don't, apart from one, I think it almost is random. I felt, as I looked at them, I saw which were going to survive. I didn't quite know till I got quite near the end. There were one or two I knew had to survive, and there was one I knew couldn't. But so to that extent, it was chance and not fate. This is a deep question.
Well, I think it is the question that the novel is about, and also that the novel comes at the crux of a time where fate is giving way to chance, even in the way people think about fiction.
Yes, indeed. For some reason, you did say the last question was the last question. It suddenly wants to make me bring up the whole of George Bernard Shaw, who pushes his characters around as though they were puppets, and yet is writing about chance and ludicrous behavior causing strange turnovers in whether you're an armaments manufacturer or whether you're a free young man kind of thing. And Shaw could have written such a play.
Well, it's interesting that you say so, because when I was reading the book, I thought, how interesting. Antonia Byatt, it's quite clear, is willing to let these characters reveal themselves by their choices, section by section, so that I don't think a reader can guess what will happen in this book, but I don't think you were guessing very far ahead either. And I thought, the god of the novel, the novelist, has consigned herself to the pleasures of dressing these characters and coloring the rooms. But what they do is their own choice.
They're not puppets.
They're not puppets.
And one of the things I say in answer to reviewers who get very annoyed that there isn't a character with which they feel either they can identify or the author can identify is I say, well, actually, the author is a character who is in the book and is watching. And they say, who are you? Which of them are you? And I say, well, I'm the writer. But the writer is subject to not knowing what's going on. As you have just said, the writer is an actor and is watching, or is a puppet master who might drop the strings.
Well, I think that the writer is supervising effects of lighting from time to time, that the same face lit one way can seem to be serene and placid, but another dour and dark. But in particular, it seemed to me that the writer had made a very odd and interesting choice. If I can't direct them, I can dress them. These characters are sumptuously dressed, whether in their own clothing or frequently in costumes, and these are meticulously described. And I thought, in a world in which so much is out of control of the old divine idea about the author making all the decisions and pulling all the strings, well, yes, it must be awfully fun to still be able to dress the characters as if they were dolls.
I wasn't really doing it like that. It's that I imagine people from inside. And when I'm writing about somebody, talking to somebody, I'm actually sitting in their body, you know, moving my hand as they move their hand, looking out of their eyes. And I need to know whether I'm looking out from under a great big hat with a feather or whether I'm not. And I need to know, oddly, particularly with women, how their clothes fit on their waist. And it was very, very different in those days. The movements you could make were different. And I can't imagine their bodies without imagining their clothes. It must have been very different to have a great big leg of mutton sleeve and mittens from being wearing those kind of Art Nouveau Liberty dresses in which you actually had got flowing movement. Clothes were very important at that time because they were shifting greatly. They shifted from year to year as the women got freer and freer of the Victorian costume. So it actually matters, you know, it matters more than it looks as though it does. And I like colour, of course, and I like to know what colour they were in, or I can't be them.
I've been talking with A.S. Byatt, author most recently of the children's book published by Knopf. Thank you, Antonia, for joining me.
Thank you.
You can comment on today's show or read an excerpt from the children's book at kcrw.com/bookworm. You can podcast this program, share it with a friend, or embed it on your blog with a click of a button on our new media player at kcrw.com. My co-producer is Melinda Siegel. Alan Howard is associate producer. The technical director is Mario Diaz. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm.
Tell you everything. They're your treasured friends in prose and rhyme. Now it's Book of the Mouse Club time. To the jungles you can go in books.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is produced in the studios of KCRW Santa Monica. You can access archives of all Bookworm programs and podcast the most recent ones from our website. Go to kcrw.com/bookworm. Plus, copies are available. For ordering information, call 310-450-5183.
Books tell you everything. They're your treasured friends in prose and rhyme. Now it's Book of the Mouse Club.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Reptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air, new music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.